Hello, and welcome to SIPFA Speaks, the podcast for professionals in public finance. I'm Callahan Hager, and I'll be your host for today's episode, focused exclusively on all things SIPFA International. We've got a great lineup of discussions covering the upcoming international conference, future research on sustainability reporting in the global public sector, and SIPFA's international advisory work. Stay tuned to hear from PFM experts Tim Youngberry and Gordon Ferrier. But up first is SIPFA's International Director, Khaled Hamid, and Program Officer Yasmina Popovich from the Center of Excellence in Finance. Thanks both for joining me on SIPFA Speaks today.
Thanks for having us.
Now, before we get onto the conference itself, Yasmina, would you mind giving our listeners an overview of the CEF and the work that you're doing in Southeastern Europe?
Thank you, Carl. With pleasure. Well, our webpage says that CEF supports capacity development for finance officials in Southeast Europe through learning. In practice, that means that we've adopted and also developed innovative learning methods to present many times complex public finance topics in a way that it is more relatable and relevant to the daily tasks of career developments of our beneficiaries. And we do this by connecting the knowledge of experts from renowned institutions with the experiences of public officials from the region. One of our main focuses is also EU accession negotiations of several countries in the region. Many of our learning activities are created to support the accession processes, like successful preparation and implementation of the economic reform program. And we are proud that our hard work over the past 20 years since the CEF was established has resulted in CEF becoming one of the most recognized and respected knowledge hubs in the region and wider. It's also important to note that we couldn't have achieved all this without the support of our partners, TIPFA, of course, being one of them and one we successfully cooperate with for many years now.
Great. And do you mind sharing a little bit about your background and how much work you've been doing in public finance?
At the CEF, I'm responsible for designing and delivering learning program for public sector accountants. In the past 6 years since I joined the CEF, I have implemented many certification trainings for accountants and auditors as well in Montenegro, North Macedonia, and Serbia. For the last year, I'm delivering training program for public officials in Bosnia and Herzegovina who are involved in preparation of economic reform program.
Thanks for that, Yasmina. And now, Khaled, SIPFA is partnering with the CEF for our international conference. Can you tell us a little bit about the new partnership and why you're excited to be collaborating on this international conference?
Thanks, Cal. Absolutely. And I think in line with what Yasmina just said, if you understand that what we're trying to do at SIPFA is we're trying to look at working across different parts of the world, but with strategic partnerships, because exactly as Yasmina said, you can't work in a region unless people who have got ground reality understand what's going on. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to use our programs, which have a global nature, but then make sure they're contextualized to the environments. And CEF is a perfect partner because it's, first of all, got a track record of quality work over a period of time where they continue to build on and make sure the foundations are there in the practice of professionalizing the public sector. And then secondly, they've been using our programs in the past and again, contextualizing them successfully. So it was a natural partnership, and it's one which I think can only grow in strength, hopefully, from this conference. And we're really looking forward to it, yeah.
Now, turning to the conference itself, Yasmina, I'm sure you must have been very busy over the past several weeks. How's the conference planning going?
It was really, really busy. And I have to say that this journey of preparing everything for the conference in the last 6 months, together with colleagues from TIPFA, was really exciting and fun. It was also an opportunity for both teams to get to know each other better, since we are organizing first joint event, and to also align our views. And brainstorming sessions with our teams and with experts were really, really inspiring. We came up with an interesting agenda for the conference that we will organize in North Macedonia on 29th and 30th June. We will address hot topics relevant for public finance professionals based in the region, but also those abroad. We will discuss asset management, anti-corruption, leadership for reforms, and training achievements and needs of both professions, so accountants and auditors. And there will be about 30 experts sharing with us success stories, talking about challenges that these discussion areas bring to different countries and what are possible solutions to overcome them and improve public finance in general.
It sounds like a packed program. Khaled, kind of getting your views on this. Why are these topics important and why are they relevant for the sector? And maybe more importantly, which ones are you most excited for?
The reason why we're really excited and across the different topics, I think they all kind of have an overlap and a synergy between them. The asset management and the corruption are essentially subject matters that are absolutely essential and topical, as Yasmina said, for lots of reasons. The asset management is one of the things that's a journey to professionalization. People need to know what assets they have and they have to account for them and use them effectively, because it's a lot of money goes into procuring assets in the public sector everywhere. And corruption, I don't need to say anymore, really. It's ubiquitous around the world right now, and saying that, look, ultimately, as we've seen with COVID, if you don't look at corruption, it will destroy everything around it. It's seen as a cancer, which basically will destroy everything and you won't achieve the objectives you're looking for, no matter how professional you become, if the leakages are there with the corruption. Both of those areas will need that leadership, which we're looking at the leadership issue. And the leadership, again, comes back to what we were saying before with this conference, which is different, is that we want to understand it from a context. It's not a copy and paste. It's not leadership is done the same way, take a textbook or a standard practice and that's it, you've done it. These are difficult, complex issues, political and as well as technical, and we need to understand that context and help get practitioners to understand that. An accountant and an auditor are trained in very, very technically, but they're not really able to understand the political environment and other dimensions of political economy. So I think it's trying to bring those things across that we have. And mainly, we've also really got a strong academic slant. So we're not just talking about practitioners and what happens now. We're also looking at, well, what's the theory saying? What is the academic research bringing to the table? And if we want to be true professionals, you have to link theory and practice. And I think what happens often with our, in our profession is that we end up training people in certain practices, but people don't understand why. And that's really what we're trying to bring from this conference. And at the end, in the last session, we bring together all the different sessions and we'll talk about how you learn and how you develop. So I think I'm hoping it's going to have those dimensions in a really interesting way.
That sounds really great. Maybe the secondary motto would be bringing together theory and practice for this event. Now that we've covered the content of the event, I'm more curious about the logistics. So how is this event actually going to work? What will the experience be like for those in attendance? To be quite honest, the first thing that comes to mind is the pandemic and travel restrictions. So Yasmina, I'll turn that one over to you.
Thank you, Carl. Well, this pandemic situation really put some boundaries to our organization and made it more difficult, but we will make sure that we overcome them with all available technical support. So this event will be in a hybrid format. We have 100 places in person and COVID measures will be in place at the venue. All sessions will be also broadcasted digitally and we have spots for 200 digital delegates. The focus was on having this a really engaging and interactive event for all attendees. We've seen interest in in-person events and want to provide quality interaction with leading officials from both the region and international community. We expect that majority of experts will be with us in Skopje. Those who won't be able to travel due to COVID restrictions will join us through an online stream. Hybrid format of event will ensure to all attendees, those from online streaming and those from the conference room, to take part in a discussion.
So just to clarify for our listeners, the event will be free, but delegates will have to apply to attend. You mentioned some limited spots there.
Yes, yes, they all need to apply. So whoever is interested to come to the conference, he or she should visit the CEF website to apply for it. So just go to cef-see.org and choose the button Start Learning. Once the event calendar opens, search for the conference under June events and apply there. We will also have lots of posts on different social media, such as Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and others, with some guidance how to apply. And as you said, Carl, there are limitations and we will need to select candidates if we receive more applications than we can accept. For now, the deadline for applications is May 31st, and we hope we will see as many as possible of interested candidates.
That's it. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
That was Khaled Hamid and Yasmina Popovic on the upcoming international conference. Just a reminder for our listeners, the hybrid event will be taking place on the 29th and 30th of June. Spots are limited, so those wanting to attend need to submit an application, which can be found on CIPFA social media channels and the CEF website. Now over to PFM expert Tim Youngberry to discuss sustainability reporting in the public sector and CIPFA's latest research on the topic.
Thanks for joining us all the way from Australia today, Tim.
Thanks, Cal. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So to kick things off today, can you give our listeners a bit of info about you and your background?
Thanks, Cal. Well, as you mentioned, I'm a public finance consultant at the moment and have been for the last 6 or 7 years. Prior to that, I was with the Ministry of Finance here in Australia, working on whole of government accounting, the budget framework in particular. I was responsible for an IT development for the budget system for some time, and I usually got lumbered with any reporting changes or the like as part of my responsibilities as well. So one of the things that I did when I was there was a thing called spatial accounting, which was really reporting government expenditure by geography rather than by program and the like. Prior to working in the Ministry of Finance, I was the Chief Finance Officer at what is now the Department of Social Services in Australia, so the Social Welfare Ministry, and also with the Defence Materiel Organisation, so the part of Defence that buys and maintains all of the defence equipment. I've also been a member of the International Public Sector Accounting Standards Board. I was a member there from 2010 to 2015.
Right, so really comprehensive experience in PFM.
Yeah, and certainly in the public sector and the value of financial reporting and non-financial reporting to good public financial management.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you worked a lot with different reporting changes. I think that kind of segues us into our main topic of today. Can you tell us a little bit more about sustainability reporting, what that actually means in the public sector?
Yeah, I think to me, sustainability reporting is a bit of a catchphrase, particularly at the moment, but probably always has been. Because I think it means different things to different people. And when sustainability reporting is talked about at the moment, I think people have at the front of their mind, it's all about environmental performance or climate change or the like, when it actually has a much broader remit and, you know, dates back right back into the 1990s and I guess started even before that with balanced scorecard reporting, triple bottom line, and I'll talk a little bit about triple bottom line reporting and my experience there in the early 2000s. And it's really about trying to report the things that matter, because when you report on the things that matter, you manage the things that matter. And I guess that's fundamental to what sustainability and reporting is about to me, which is let's not just worry about the money. We still need to worry about the money, but there are other things that are just as important as the financial performance of an organization. And to me, sustainability reporting is trying to bring those other things that are important to the organization together so that you actually get a more comprehensive view of what organizational performance really means.
Obviously, you're very knowledgeable in sustainability reporting. Have you worked specifically with public sector sustainability reporting before? And if so, have you seen any trends?
So I have worked with sustainability reporting previously. So when I was the Chief Finance Officer at what was called the Department of Family and Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, which is now called the Department of Social Services, we started a piece of work to produce what was then called a triple bottom line report for the department. And there were a couple of drivers behind why the department chose to do that. One, and I guess probably the most important, was the government had a program at the time called the Prime Minister's Community Business Partnership. And one of the elements within that program was to encourage the corporate sector to take up triple bottom line reporting. And whilst there was some appetite in the corporate sector to have a broader view of performance, one of the questions that was often put to the program officers when they were, you know, talking to industry and talking to the corporate sector was, okay, well, you're asking us to do this. What does the government do in this space? And it was always fairly embarrassing, I think, that the answer went back, well, the government doesn't do any of this. And, you know, the minister at the time was particularly keen to say, well, that's not a satisfactory answer. I think we really should try this and we should pilot a triple bottom line report for the department. Now, I was fairly fortunate as the CFO at the time that I had two staff members who were particularly enthusiastic with particularly environmental issues. And we formed a little project team. It was only 2.5 people working on it to try and pull together a triple bottom line report for the department. And this was back in 2002, 2003, the first time that we did it. And it was interesting that the comments we received from others were really around, well, A, why are you doing this? It's not mandated, it's not required, so why bother? To which we would usually respond about ministerial priorities, consistency of government programs and delivery and the like. And I guess the other part was having an organisational view of particularly the non-financial aspects of our performance. So how much electricity did we use? You know, back then it was measured more in, I think we measured in kilowatt hours rather than tons of CO2, but the concept was there, and it was really about trying to get a better measure of what our consumption was on particular things. And to me, that was about, you know, how sustainable are these things that we're doing? And are there things that we're not aware of that can make us perform better? And I still remember one of the examples from back then was office lighting. They came in and, you know, we had these light wells in the ceilings, and I think they took 3 fluorescent tubes each. And my staff, you know, did some work, and they, you know, spoke to the lighting experts and so on, and they discovered that if we replaced the tubes that we currently used with a different type of tube, we could go from using 3 tubes down to 2, and that would reduce our electricity consumption by a certain amount. So it was really about producing a report that provided information against which we could then make some decisions, and trying to build that into a management process so that it improved the performance of the department overall. I guess it was a challenging journey. There's a lot of, when anything new happens, there's always naysayers. Right. There are people are saying, well, why do it? You know, there's too much risk. You don't have the data. It's too difficult. There's no requirements. You know, you can reel out lots and lots of reasons. But at the end of the day, I think the old adage of what gets measured gets managed comes back. And if you're not measuring it, there's no chance that you're managing it. And from an organisational performance perspective, I think that's quite important. I think in terms of trends, I think there was a flurry of activity back around the turn of the century with this type of reporting. I think probably after the global financial crisis, the money side of the equation became more important in everybody's mind. And I think it probably fell away a little bit. I think what we're seeing now in the corporate sector, probably over the last 3 or 4 years, maybe a little bit longer, is that greater focus on whole of organisation performance, not just financial performance. And I think we're seeing investor demand now manifest itself, particularly around the climate risk that organisations face. I think the public sector probably lags the corporate sector a little bit in this space because it doesn't have that same demand pool for information. Information is quite often only produced if there is some parliamentary or political interest in a particular area. And I don't think that's yet happening in the public sector. I think it's happening with the private sector, but it needs to gain it in its awareness and visibility for public sector reporting.
Right. So, I mean, clearly you have a really, really nice history and nice bit of exposure to sustainability reporting specific to public sector organizations and governments. Now you're leading on the SIPFA research program into this topic. Do you mind telling us a little bit more about that research program?
So I think this is a very good initiative that SIPFA started, and it's really about getting a measure of what's the state of play. Like, anecdotes are really useful in terms of, I suppose, illustrating a thought or illustrating an idea, but they don't actually give you a reasonable view of what is happening in a particular area. So I think this research is really about, you know, taking a first look at what is the current state of sustainability reporting across the public sector. Now, at the moment, there's a particular focus on climate and environment, which is understandable given we all observe what goes on in the world around us each day. The research is really about, you know, taking that first measure. So getting a look at, you know, what's going on, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities, what are the impediments to starting sustainability reporting in an organisation? And are there ways that people who might be interested in starting a sustainability reporting journey in their organisation, can it give them some ideas on what to do and perhaps how to go about doing it?
And lastly, what do you hope this upcoming report achieves?
What I hope it achieves is that it raises awareness, firstly, for all those that have an interest in the performance of the public sector. So it's not just those with an interest in, for example, financial or economic matters. It's not just those with an interest in social initiatives or social measures. And it's not just for those with a particular interest in environmental issues. It's really about how the public sector performs in the discharge of its functions. So if we can at least raise awareness across the spectrum of why sustainability reporting is important, what are the challenges in doing it, so that people can then turn their minds to, well, if we're going to do it, this gives us a head start in terms of how we do sustainability reporting. So I guess there's probably two aspects that I hope it achieves. One is that awareness raising, and secondly, that it provides some impetus for those organisations that want to start but haven't been quite sure about how to start or where to start.
Right. Really fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for your time, Tim.
Not a problem. Thanks, Cal.
You're listening to CIPFA Speaks, and that was Tim Youngberry sharing his perspective on sustainability and CIPFA's upcoming report. For our interested listeners, keep an eye out. The full report on public sector sustainability reporting practices will be published early next month. Now over to CIPFA Associate Gordon Ferrier, who joined me earlier in the week, for an update on the work he's doing abroad with our international advisory team.
Welcome, Gordon, to CIPFA Speaks. Thanks for joining us for today's international-themed episode.
Thanks, Cal. It's good to be here.
So let's kick things off. Can you tell us a bit about your background and how long you've worked for CIPFA?
I became a CPFA in 1977 and a fellow of CIPFA in 2016. From a career in the public sector in Scotland, I was hired by CIPFA in 1990 to set up their first education and training centre in Scotland, operating alongside the original centre, the CETC, in London, and a second centre that had opened in Belfast. I led the CETC in Scotland for 8 years, during which time we trained several hundred CIPFA accountants and other non-financial managers. Then I left to set up my own consultancy firm in 2004. I was hired again by CIPFA to help them with a sister organisation in South Africa, the Institute for Public Finance and Auditing. And I spent about a year in Pretoria developing a competency-based training programme for public sector staff in South Africa. That took me back into CIPFA in London in March 2005 as an assistant director in the newly formed International Directorate. Towards the end of 2014, I was appointed as the head of global membership for CIPFA, and that kept me occupied until I left CIPFA at the end of 2015. Since then, I've worked fairly regularly with CIPFA on various consultancy assignments, and those have continued to the present.
Great. Now, you mentioned that you've already done previous work on competency frameworks. Would you mind giving our listeners an idea of what exactly a competency framework is and how it links to CIPFA's overall mission?
Sure. A competency framework is a set of competencies. Now, of course, that goes on to beg the question, what do we mean by a competency? There's no universal agreement on what that is, but CIPFA follows one very widely accepted definition, that competency consists of a collection of behaviours, skills, knowledge and attitudes. Those terms all have their own particular meaning in this context. Behaviour describes what we do, skill, what we are capable of doing, although we may not always do it, knowledge, what we know, and attitudes describe our evaluation of things, the importance or significance we attach to people, places, events, almost anything, in fact. These four components of competency are connected, and together they constitute what CIPFA describes as competency. In relation to PFM, a competency framework, therefore, is really only a collection of these four factors that can be used to measure the strength of PFM in an organisation. It also functions as a way of defining the key competencies that people working in PFM should have, and therefore of setting out a basis for training, learning and other forms of development. Since CIPFA's mission is about improving PFM, then competencies offer a very practical basis for achieving that mission through education, training, learning, and other forms of personal and organizational development.
All right. And so you work with our international advisory team. What are some of the latest or biggest projects you've been working on?
We've just finished a large project in Bangladesh, which consisted of developing a competency framework for PFM staff working in government in the country. The framework we developed there was actually two frameworks. One consisted of what we've come to call general competencies and the other technical competencies. General competencies are ones that aren't necessarily PFM specific. For example, communication is something that most people need to be able to do, not just PFM specialists. By contrast, estimating spending need by programme or sector is a competency that only staff working with budgets would need, and planning and managing internal audits is one that only internal auditors would need. The technical competencies we developed for Bangladesh run to 51 pages, but any given member of staff would only need to have a few of these competencies, depending on their role in the finance function. Elsewhere, we're in the middle of a project in Albania at the moment, which includes developing a competency framework for finance staff there. This work is part of a wider project to help government adopt international public sector accounting standards. The competencies in the framework are therefore all designed to support that, although even in this situation, it isn't as simple as saying we only produce accounting competencies. In discussion with government, for example, we eventually settled on a core domain of accounting and reporting that was supported by competencies in other domains such as training, learning and development, because the work that we were hired to do also included training trainers in Albania to be able to train other members of staff in IPSAS once our work is over.
The two projects that you mentioned, one is in Southeast Asia, one is in Southeast Europe. I mean, how much do these projects vary between countries? Obviously, those two nations are quite different. I'm sure their governments are quite different as well. These country-specific needs that you see, are they following a wider trend internationally?
The core of the work of producing a competency framework is broadly constant. The circumstances in which the framework is to operate is one of the key determining factors in what it contains. Countries can also have their own emphases. In Laos, for example, they also want to produce a competency dictionary to sit alongside the framework. And of course, in almost all these countries, English is not the first language, and therefore we need to take care to ensure that we use words and expressions that are as clear and as simple as possible. But there does appear to be a broad trend at the moment for countries to be looking to develop competency frameworks. I'd like to think that started with the work that CIPFA did in South Africa back in 2004. And certainly we can see echoes of what we did in the Philippines in 2013, where we produced a competency framework for the 60,000 or so PFM staff in government in the country, in some of the terms of reference that are being issued today. Because the field is still relatively new, the biggest trend is that governments are seeing the need to be systematic in how they train PFM staff. Before this, there wasn't really that consistency. PFM training might be concentrated on budgeting in one country, in accounting in another, auditing in a third.
And lastly, Gordon, you must have some interesting stories. Is there any particular story that comes to mind that you'd be keen to share with our listeners?
I can remember my first mission to Ethiopia, for example. Even though Band-Aid had taken place about 20 years before that, there was still a huge amount of poverty in the country. One of the first things I did there was to sit down with the chief executive of the Ethiopian Civil Service College and share a meal with him. It was Zilzil Tibbs. Braised beef and a sauce of tomatoes, onions and spices. We ate it with injera, an Ethiopian flatbread with a slightly spongy texture, sharing a single plate of food. That sharing made a big impression on me because it highlighted something we had in common in an environment that was so different from what I had been accustomed to in the UK. In the same country, I remember being invited to the home of one of the staff at the Civil Service College, Belainesh Gebre Mariam. She cooked lunch on an open fire in the middle of her living room and roasted coffee beans. She was dressed in traditional costume, a colourful sari-like garment with a headdress, whilst at the same time the TV set in the living room was showing Manchester United's game that day. The combination of the traditional and the modern was something else that struck me. The images were also very different from those of the poverty and destitution that Band-Aid had shown, and it helped me to see a wider picture of what life was like in the country.
That's great. Thanks, Gordon. Really interesting perspective there. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for asking me and giving me this opportunity.
You've been listening to CIPFA Speaks. Thanks again to Gordon for joining us. That wraps up today's international episode. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you again next time.